Hello, and welcome to the Strength to Be Human podcast with your host, author and playwright Mark Anthony Rossi. This show explores all forms of creativity for those searching for meaning and a place in the world. To err is human, but so is to love. Now, without further ado, here's your host.
Good afternoon, folks. This is Mark Anthony Rossi with Strength to Be Human, the podcast. This is episode number 17, another wonderful interview segment. This one is on a playwright, and I'm so glad because as a playwright myself, I've been wanting to interview those. But like anything else, it takes some time and scheduling. Thank God we have Kat Roden Grogan with us. She is a playwright and I believe an educator as well. She has written a number of plays. One that she's quite, I think, well-known and won the Critics' Choice Award was with May I Have Your Attention, Please. I want to welcome Kat to the show. Kat, thank you very much for being here. And we also have her guest with us on the show, and you'll hear about him later on. His name is Matt Riefelberg, and he is one of the subjects of those plays. So we're going to have that unusual occurrence here on an artistic show where a subject can actually talk as well. Maybe we can get some questions about that. So this is going to be really fascinating, interesting, and totally unique. Kat, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, Mark. I want to say I really do appreciate this opportunity to come speak with you about playwriting and about this specific play. Because of the many plays I've written, this one is very unique. I've learned a lot from it. And it's something that I would like to share the process of today. And I'm glad that Matt could be with us because I think he, as you will see when we talk about the process, it's been so unique and he's very vital to that process and it couldn't have worked without him. So I'm really, really excited to talk about the new play, which is entitled Unstoppable by Design. And I really like that title, which
me too.
That's one of the questions that people often ask, but you know, titles are often very difficult to come up with, but when you hear the right one, you just like a bell goes off and you just know it. So yes. I think back to the moment that we titled the play and, you know, we were just saying like all these crazy kind of titles. I mean, you know, just the ones that never, you just know they're not it. And so it was in a text conversation and, you know, he just like out of this funny type titles, he typed Unstoppable by Design. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, why have you been typing like all these other crazy things? That is the title. And, you know, so I just knew, and I think he knew as well that was it. So.
Oh, I love it. I love the title. And I love that you have an appreciation for titles because we have listeners out there, a number who are not playwrights, but they will all tell you publicly and privately, whether it's a poem or a fiction piece or even a song. I got a couple songwriters that are going to be coming up later in the springtime, that title can transfix the person. They might not have anything else but the title, but they are so convinced that when they do, it's going to be a fabulous project. And lots of people, including myself, literally swear by that. So I'm all for what you're talking about.
Great. So Unstoppable by Design, I think the backstory of it is almost as interesting as the play itself. You know, generally when I've written plays, an idea, they've been fiction and, you know, there'll be like a character that comes to mind or I'll see a phrase or something like that triggers me with the idea. This was a little different. And so I think everyone will be just as fascinated with how it came to be as they will be compelled with this story once we start talking about, you know, what the play is actually about. But my father had passed away in September of 2017, which was the most traumatic experience of my life. And, you know, writing, I have been writing my whole life. And after that point, there was a disconnect from the trauma of losing my father. So I really, writing was always a coping mechanism, and that was gone. And so I kept thinking, if I could just get that back, then maybe I could start to heal from this. But it would be about a year before anything, would connect in my mind. And I was reading on social media and on Quora, just reading through random things like I would do during that period after my father passed. And so you mentioned, was a teacher. And I was reading a post someone had made about all these things going wrong in their life. And was their life over? And I mean, this person was young, like in their 20s. And they were already thinking, that there was no future, like their whole life was over. Wow. And so that's what caught my attention, because, I sort of had a similar feeling after my father's death that maybe life was over for me as well, because I couldn't connect. It was just a mourning that I couldn't come out of. But that caught my attention, and Matt actually had responded, telling of some things in his life that had happened and, how that he had moved forward. So that was really compassionate to me, and that's what really caught my attention at first and made me want to read further. But one of the things he had mentioned was that he had dropped out of high school. And then there was a link to an article on Catalyst. So I clicked to read that. And I saw that, this person who drops out of high school, they get a job at Cornell University. And so from my own experience with students, most of them who drop out, don't have that kind of experience later on. So the teacher part of me just started connecting a little bit. And I thought, maybe this is a play idea that I could actually, it was just that writing process light that goes off sometimes. It just hit me. Maybe this is something that I could do something with. At least it intrigued me enough that I thought, I'm going to contact him and just ask if maybe I can write his story. It was a few years old, the post, so I didn't know if I would reach him. And certainly didn't know how he would react, but, I didn't have anything to lose at that point. So I just sent that off, and he was very quick to respond with, that he was favorable about exploring the possibility of letting me tell the story. And at that point, I just knew the technical part, drop out of high school, get this great job. So, I had no idea of what was to come as we went through, the interview process. There was so much more to the story, and it's just been fascinating. So that's a little overview of what you can expect as we go through this today, I think.
I think it's incredible, and I really think that folks don't really understand, and I'm hoping they'll understand more when they hear what you have to say, that oftentimes creative people, writers particularly, they're going through their own traumas. They're going through their own private hells. And oftentimes, the writing itself can not only lead them out of there, but can help other folks to see a better day as well. And that's really what's happened here. And it's really a story that needs to be told over and over again, particularly to other creative people. When they get into those situations in life that can stop them, or what they call the writer's block, this is the sort of thing that can help get somebody off to the other end of that and back on the right track. So thank you very much for bringing that to our attention. I'm thrilled for the next segment of this.
Well, I think the next segment would be talking about, the response and how we went about the process. you know, once he initially said yes, that, you know, we could explore doing this, you know, at first, and I think this would be a good place for Matt to interject his thoughts, but when I first contacted you, Matt, you know, what were your thoughts? Here's a random person wanting to, you know, write your life story.
First of all, hello, everyone. So my feeling at first was I was a little taken aback by it because I don't feel that my story is anything special. Other people have said differently, but I mean, it was just kind of like my life and it just how it transpired. And I don't see it as anything great or inspiring or whatever, but other people do. So when Kat asked me about writing the play, I said, sure, you know, it would be interesting. Interesting to see what she came up with. And that's what kind of pushed me to let her tell the story.
And, you know, we started the process then through email. And I sent him some questions and, you know, he answered them by email. And so that's how it began. And I could see he was very forthcoming to answer anything that I asked him. But he was not the same as me, like in being, you know, if you ask me something, like I'll tell you that plus a million other things because I just, you know, that's just how I am. I'm like that. But he wasn't like that. So he would answer everything and he was very open, even about things that possibly, you know, he would have done differently or maybe views as mistakes at that time. But I had to ask the question. So, you know, I figured that part out and I got better with asking questions. And now he probably wishes I never figured that part out because, you know, I never have stopped. Because I just wanted to know, like, it was like a puzzle in a way or like solving a mystery. Everything led me to another question. And so I'd get that answered and I'd find, you know, like, well, this is fascinating and I can't believe this happened too. So, I mean, it became much more than a high school dropout that gets the job at Cornell. There's so many things in between that it's, I mean, people that will see the play or read the play, they walk away, I think, just being so fascinated that he just didn't give up because there were so many times, and we all experience things, even my father's death, where I thought, I'm giving up. This is it. I can't. You know, I can't move past this, and that this is different for everyone. But he seemed to have so many thises that happened that you just think, how does one person motivate themselves to do that? And so we went through the process starting with email, and then we started with texting, and so, I mean, it wasn't unusual for there to be 30,000 texts in a month. It just, we connected in a really unique way, I think, a way I didn't expect. Because, you know, here's a stranger, and you spend a month with that stranger, and you know, like, their whole life story.
Wow.
But you know, but they're still a stranger to you. And so this story is just fascinating and everything about it has been fascinating to me. So I just, that's why I wanted to be on here and talk about this because it's just so different from any play that I've written, but it does have challenges. And one of the challenges was once, you know, he started telling me more things and I'd ask more things, you know, now I've got like this person's whole life story. And for the guidelines of what I was writing this play for, the reading that will be performed next month, it had to be a one act play. So I was looking at 45 minutes at the most.
Yeah, that's pushing it.
Right. And so, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I've contacted this stranger. We spent all this time together. I've got all this information. Now what if I can't write the play? Because you have to remember, you know, I'm not in the best place of my whole life in writing at this point. But yet I need that. I need it more than at any other time in my life, too. So I'm just thinking, you know, I will find a way. There is a way that I can tell this story. And so once I was able to figure out this is where I'm starting, these are the things that I want to put in there, then I was okay with it, and it seemed to flow well. And, you know, I think we probably spent 6 weeks, and the play was finished. And it was, really amazing. It turned out very well, I think.
Well, I do have a question. I'm sure it probably is on the minds of people that are going to be listening to this show. And, of course, it's on my mind. When you mention that you're writing this because you also need it as well, and, of course, you're still in direct contact with this fellow, Matt, do you ever concern yourself with, could I not be shortchanging him just because I want to get it finished and because I need it as well? Because you don't have as much distance as an average playwright would do to the subject.
I don't think I ever thought of it that way. I think I thought of, you know, I don't want to let him down because I had that connection for him and for his story. And I needed to feel like I could still do something. And I mean, his story is he's done all these things. So it made me reevaluate, you know. I mean, I'm writing this play that has a message, and I'm the one that needs the message. So
wow.
I don't think I was shortchanged in that way. I think I was motivated by it.
Yeah, and I didn't mean that in some sort of like negative way. But sometimes what happens is the closer we get to the subject, sometimes there's things that we wind up missing.
Yeah, well, there were definitely, I think I got too much information in that, you know, I couldn't include everything, so.
Maybe that's a good thing, then.
Well, in this case, you know, it leaves room for if we, well, we'll talk about future projects possibly later, but, I can see how, I can see it both ways, but I think in this particular case, for me, it was the message I needed. So, you know, I think I was pretty objective. And maybe, Matt, you know, how do you feel about it? Because you read the final and you know all we went through.
Well, I mean, Kat was pretty open to letting me give her input and change things as I saw fit. And there were a couple things that I changed just to make them more real and closer to what happened. It's a sort of a fictional take on the events in my life, but they're pretty close to how they actually happened. So I just, you know, added a little more detail or changed a few things that I wouldn't personally do, or people who are involved, who are characters in the play, wouldn't actually say. So in that aspect, we worked really well together, and I think the final result is pretty damn good.
So. Well, that's amazing to hear, mainly because when somebody's a subject to something, regardless of how much regard and respect they have for that creator, there's always the inevitable feeling of, you know, did I get it out in terms of the essential truth? Because many a times, anything that's written, even in a fictional sense, it rings the best to people when they feel that there's something authentic in there, that there is a number of truths that are being told, regardless if it's absolutely 100% literal or not. As long as they feel that that's been covered, then I think also the person that's been written about, in your case, you know, if you feel the same way, well, that makes that project that much stronger, and I also feel that much more revealing about the subject, and even maybe in a sense to playwright. It makes it an extraordinary special vehicle that you don't really hear and see much about at all.
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of really great feedback from people who have read it, and you know, they've made comparisons to other projects out there, and it's humbling to for me personally, because I don't expect that sort of thing, and Kat did an amazing job writing, and I think it's gonna, you know, people are gonna really like it a lot, so.
Well, I definitely would want to hear some of those questions here in the next segment, but I will say that, and Kat and I had talked about this behind the scenes before, and of course I never reveal anything that would be unusual, but in this case it's perfect for what we're doing in the show right now, is that there's a great difference in reality to those that want to have a social impact and those that just simply have just some agenda that you can see on the news. So I'm always excited to hear and see work that has the social impact, that can have meaning in other people's lives, but doesn't sound like they just parroted a couple of talking points from some politician on a TV show you saw yesterday. She's doing something beyond that. That's what makes her an incredible artist, and that's what I would want to promote for everyone out there, is the people that are making a social impact that are truly making a social impact. It's just not a bunch of code words and a hogwash about something. It's something real, and I think people need to hear that. They need to hear that things happen to people for reasons. Often they happen to people because of choices they've made, good choices and bad choices. And to me, that's what a lot of this play is about. It's about ultimately the choices that we make and how good and bad, where they can lead us into our life, and trying to be responsible about those.
Right.
Well, another thing I would say, you know, I had to pull back a couple of times from things that I think would have made it more dramatic, or, you know, added a little more conflict or tension. So if I was writing it as fiction, you know, there are things I would have done differently. But like, you know, one thing he had me take out was I had him crying. And so, you know, I still like to put that back in at some point.
But, no, and I understand that.
He's not favorite. That's not his. That wasn't his choice.
Matt,
but
I got your back on that one. Okay.
A little aside
is I did an interview with a lovely lady from Bulgaria about some of my books. And one of them touched upon the death of my father, and she asked that question directly. And I just told her that wasn't part of the interview, and moved on to the next one. Behind the scenes, she was not happy because she thought I wasn't being forthright on that. But I'm like, this is my father's death. This is me. We're talking about my writing. I'm only going to go so far. I mean, I'm not going to apologize for that.
Right.
But, you know, by and large, there were very few changes. So I think I got most of the story right the first time, and I think just being a good listener, but it's different being the listener. I just felt like in this case, I was just the storyteller. You know, I wasn't the playwright necessarily that was making, it wasn't my job to add more conflict or, you know, to make it an artistic piece beyond what it already was. So for me, I just had to step back and think, you know, I'm putting it together, but this is his story. So even when we approach changes, I felt like he should have the final say in those because, you know, it's his story. And whenever people see this, you know, I'll be very proud that I had a part in it, but it's his life. He's the one that did all the work, and I really had the easy job.
Well, it's an astounding collaboration, I can tell you that right now, because you don't hear much about this sort of thing, mainly because we live right now in such a polarized society where compromising and collaborations are somehow dirty words. Yet we need more of that in our lives than ever before. So thank you, Kat, and thank you, Matt.
Yeah, she was saying that it took about 6 weeks, but really if, you know, schedules had worked out and, you know, things had come together a little differently, we probably could have written it in about a week because it was it just flowed that well. So.
And sometimes the best revealing stories, they do that. I mean, I had a fiction piece that won a writing award, and they were wondering, you know, how it came about and what I did and everything like that. And when I told them the background story of it, they thought I was making it up. I'm saying, yeah, I've had the title and the general idea for maybe about 20 years. But I had problems putting it together because I wanted to have, just like Cat in many ways, I wanted to have that particular short fiction piece to have a social impact. I wanted it to be able to say something about how the young often don't respect the old, and how sometimes the old don't respect the young, and how if they don't communicate, especially in a neighborhood environment, crazy, stupid things can happen that shouldn't.
Right.
And in the end, thank God it was positive, but it could have almost been like death involved in it. And I said to myself, until I really feel that everything lines up correctly, I'm not going to even try to put it out there. I don't want it to be one-sided, and I don't want it to be insensitive, and more importantly, I don't want it to fail on what I'm originally trying to get done. So it literally took like 20 years to put this story together, but it did very well. It's considered one of my best pieces, and I'm always very proud of thinking about how I don't want to spend another 20 years on something, but also if I have to, that was the one I wanted to do it on. Now, go ahead.
So this play is like 40-something years in the making, I guess, probably. because my story starts when I was relatively young. I quit school at 15. I lost my mother at 20. I think I was 19 or 20. She passed away very young. She was in her early 40s from cancer. And I kind of grew up without a lot of parental influence and role models and things like that. I got involved in some things that I probably shouldn't have. But I kind of lived my life on my own terms. And they say, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And there are consequences to all your actions, and this play speaks very well about some of those things. Later on, I got married and had a son, and my wife ended up with some addiction issues, and so that marriage dissolved. I remarried again, and that marriage went really well. I moved to Pennsylvania from New York, and started working at a small biotech company where I had a great boss who is one of my good friends. After 8 years there, I ended up getting laid off, and I found out during the same week that I had a brain tumor. And so the next few months were doctor's visits and things like that. I had the operation on St. Patrick's Day of the following year, and had the tumor taken out, and then spent 8 months in recovery. And while I was in recovery, I decided that I wanted to go to school and learn some software for design, because I was doing a lot of design at that point. So I kind of went to a few different companies and ended up getting a job at another biotech company, worked there for a few years. And then one day I was sitting on the deck with my wife, and I said I had gotten an email about a job at Cornell. So I applied kind of as a joke, thinking they would never hire me. And they hired me. There were 50-something applicants, and they picked me. And this was in a particle physics lab. I was designing things for particle accelerators that they had on campus and other projects around the world. And at some point, I was promoted from a design position to an engineering position, which was kind of interesting because they didn't typically do that, but I was already doing the work. So for someone who dropped out of school, hated school, didn't want to be involved in any school, to end up at a university doing what I was doing was pretty interesting. And a magazine contacted me. They heard about me somewhere and asked for my story, and I told it. The article appeared, and then someone from a large engineering company read the article and contacted me about a position in Virginia to support a project, a nuclear project. So after some back and forth, I went and did that, and now I am working for the same company on a project that is going to destroy the rest of the chemical weapons that the U.S. has in their inventory. And that's what I'm doing there. So,
that is totally incredible. It certainly is a uniquely American story in many ways, but also it speaks well to your character and to your commitment to persevere and not let things hold you back. I mean, if you can beat a brain tumor, you could probably beat anything.
Yeah, I was lucky in the fact that it was a benign tumor and I didn't have to go through chemo and all that, but, you know, they still opened my head up and, you know, I got a cool scar from the whole thing. And, it turned out to be more of a pain in the butt than anything else. But it did force me to think about my future and what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, such that it is. And, you know, just make some changes, and it's been a pretty wild ride ever since.
Well, it really is. It really is a blessing to hear it. Obviously, folks, you don't need to run out there and get a brain tumor to sort of reorganize your life. But apparently it helps.
It does. You know, thinking about your own mortality and things like that, you know, people just need to be aware that time is a precious commodity and you're only given so much of it. And my feeling is that with the time I have left, I want to do as many things and help as many people as possible, because you're not remembered for how much money you have or things like that. You're remembered for the way that you treat people and the lives you have touched by the things that you do.
And it is so true. A lot of times I've been at funerals, and I remember my father telling me before he had his funeral, and he had told me, he goes, I'm going to be laying down there soon, you know, and you're going to be able to judge me not just by the relationship that we've had, but the relationship I've had with others. And you'll see people from work, you'll see people from the outside of our family and et cetera. And then when you hear what they have to say, and then you'll really know the complete me, because sometimes you never can know your complete father, because you're looking at him with different eyes. But upon his death and upon his funeral, you know, I saw things that I didn't recognize or didn't understand. And it just made me appreciate him that much more. And I was glad to be able to carry something like that into my own life, my own children. And I can say now, as a broadcaster, I've been wanting to do this for a number of years. I've done lots of interviews, and I've always been interested. But to take that next step, to learn the equipment, and to hope that your New Jersey accent won't sound like some kind of mobster or something, is sometimes can hold you back. So I'm a perfect example of fear getting the best of you sometimes, and sometimes even wondering about the confidence of doing this, because it's not like regular writing, which I've been doing 36 years and feel completely confident about in all kinds of genres. This is an entirely different creature. And so it's been wonderful. This is episode number 17. We're doing something so unique over here that you're not going to hear in other shows. And that's all because I was willing to take a chance, on myself, take a chance on the artists out there in the world. I mean, you could even say taking a chance on Kat, but then before I took a chance on Kat, Kat took a chance on me and told people about, hey, this is a show that has some meaning and it's worth a listen to. So thank you, Kat, because I'm always grateful for something like that, especially since in the beginning you're doing it and you're like, God, I hope it connects. And I'm not even hoping for some superstar success. I'm just hoping that it does what I want it to do, to reach the people, hear what they have to say, and make a difference. And so far, so good.
Well, great. And you are doing great things with this program. So we're happy to be a part of it. And I think sharing this story and all the ones that you're sharing, it's going to resonate with a lot of people. So just I'm really, really proud of your work and pleased at what you're doing.
Thank you very much. And I'm excited for what we're going to hear in the weeks ahead about this show. Now, I think you folks had did mention that you had some questions from folks that wanted to know about the play or certain things on how it was written or certain things you might have encountered. And I think some of them were for Matt just as much as they were for you. So however you guys want to organize that, but that's something we should definitely be hearing.
Okay.
So the questions are kind of in a random order, so there's no flow to it really. But we got a lot of people who were writing Kat and asking her questions because they had read the play and wanted to know more about it. And so one of the things they wanted to know is what the toughest obstacle was in telling the story.
Again, I think it was just keeping in mind that I had only this much time to tell this much life. And just figuring out the structure of it. And so I ended up, and, you know, people, as they see the play, they'll see that I focused on starting with the Cornell interview, and then I chose the structure of these events in his life as being flashbacks. So you're going to see, you know, the interview, and then Matt at the interview. But then it will flash back to a younger Matt in the situation of whatever relates to the question that they're asking him. And so it's pretty much structured that way. And at first, I wasn't sure if the flashbacks would seem like too choppy or, you know, if it would be too repetitive. But I tried to match the dialogue so that whatever Matt is saying at the interview, the character in the flashback is saying that same dialogue at the same time. So that sort of bridged into the flashback. And I think it turned out working rather well, but that was the challenge. The most difficult thing was just fitting it all in and figuring out the structure. Once I did that, it told itself, basically.
So people want to know how this is different than other plays you've written. You might want to talk about.
Well, for sure, this is about a real person. And the only other thing that was close to a real person was I'm from Jellicoe, Tennessee. So yay for my hometown of Jellicoe. But we do have Grace Moore, who was a famous opera singer from the 40s. And so she's the only other person that I had written about that was an actual person. She also died in a plane crash. So, you know, writing about her, she had already passed. So most of my plays are, you know, completely fiction. And this one was different in that way. I hadn't used the flashback scene completely, you know, for the whole structure. So that was different. But just, I think, also, and we joked about this a lot, Matt is the only character, main character I did it, you know, that doesn't die in my plays. So, you know, every time I'd be like joking or whatever, I'd be like, okay, you know, tomorrow you might, you know, I might kill you off. And, you know, I still say that, like, it hasn't had its reading yet. So there's still time to get rid of him.
Yeah. Matt's like, I want it to stay that way, okay? Please.
You know, let me put crying back in or you're gone.
No. somebody asked what my IQ was. I really don't know. Apparently people think I'm pretty smart, but I'm just...
And he is.
I'm just me. I mean, I don't think I'm any smarter than anyone else.
Not smarter than me, but he's smart.
Well, I'm not really surprised with that question. And I don't know if I have an answer to it, but what I do know from experience of dealing with lots of people is the naturally gifted You usually don't think they're that special, but they are.
Well, that may be true. I mean, I don't think I am. I don't think I've done anything that anyone else couldn't do. I mean, obviously there are things that I wouldn't wish people had to go through, but I don't think my experience is unique. So,
well, definitely in the sense of the effort to preserve and go forward and try to be creative. Sure, lots of people do that, but when you cross over to some of the areas you've done, you obviously have some natural gifts. Because, you know, before the show, I had to go take care of the dishes in the dishwasher and unstuff the toilet bowl. I mean, I'm serious. I really had to do this stuff. It's a Sunday. I had to, like, make sure the house is okay. I'm thinking, and maybe because I'm not scientific, but I'm thinking there's a big difference between me using the plunger and the toilet bowl and the particle accelerator, okay? So let's trust the universe to Matt and not to Mark, okay?
Okay. Let's see.
We had a lot of questions. I was really, really happy that people, you know, were so engaged in the story that they wanted to know more. That was a good sign to me.
Well, because at the heart of it, it is really a kid that eventually was able to do right and overcame a number of obstacles, some that were put into his path by himself and others that simply happened. And still was able to make good and do something worthy for the world. I think that some people, this sort of thing has happened to them in a certain extent, and then others, they probably wish that for somebody that they know. So it's very appealing on that deep human level.
I agree. I mean, I think that everyone that sees this will find some situation in his story that they will relate to, you know, divorce, whether it be divorce or it be addiction or even illness, you know, or even dropping out of school. You know, school is not for everyone. They may feel, I know with just teaching, you know, there are many reasons that kids just don't feel like school is the answer for them. And, I'm not encouraging people to drop out of school, of course, because teaching, you know, and here's something from the interview I remember. You know, I asked Matt, like, wasn't there one person at the school, one teacher, one someone that you felt, you know, tried to talk you into staying? And it really, you know, his answer seemed to be that there wasn't. And so, as an educator and just as a person, that really, you know, that hurts me to think that students often feel, well, you know, whether it's true that that's the case or not, it's their perception that no one cares about them. And so when kids get to that point and they drop out, often they go on through the rest of their life on a bad path because no one cared enough to keep them in school, and no one cares. Certainly people care even less, you know, after you leave school. You're just thrown out into the big world, which is really tough, a really, really tough place. So, you know, that was an interesting answer for me, but that's something I wanted to know is, you know, why no one cared. Or why he felt no one cared.
It's a big society question. Something I'm intently interested in myself. I actually had the chance to give some feedback back to this Trump administration. And one of the things I had talked to them about that they seem to have a real agreement on is trying to revive or bring back that technical trade school aspect that we used to have in society. And also to try to make sure that unions can go back to offering some apprenticeships, because many of these things in the 60s and 70s, they propelled students into the middle class who didn't really have a real drive in education. It didn't mean they wasn't intelligent. It just means that they were not focused on that. That wasn't where
exactly
their talents were. You know, and I don't mean to belittle any of this, but, you know, if you have a gift for auto mechanics, what the heck does a pronoun mean to you? It doesn't mean anything. And I'm a writer saying that, so it's not hard to figure this out, folks, you know?
Well, I mean, here is another good aspect of the play in that it does spotlight technical education. And, you know, oftentimes in plays, it's like artists and people like that, that their life stories get told. But, you know, here is a real person, a real human that has all these flaws and
hey,
all these.
Wait a minute.
I was getting ready to praise you next. You know, all these great qualities. Great qualities, because, I mean, we're sitting here talking about his life. So obviously, you know, those few flaws are not even, they're just like a tiny, tiny part of what he is. And often that gets missed. But I think this play, for all those listening out there that will be looking for a play, you know, that maybe will motivate some of these students that are in technical education to see that, you know, this is a great choice for people. And so I'm really pleased that this play is different in that way as well.
I'm hoping it adds more to the debate of that re-emerging in society. So this way, teachers don't feel so hampered that they can't say anything other than to commit somebody to a system that maybe doesn't really appeal to them or doesn't reach out to them, and then feel themselves like they're failures, and therefore they can't help, and then the student thinks that they don't care either, when that might not be the case, that the teacher might care greatly, but they don't feel like they have too many options themselves, or they don't want to actually portray their own career in a strange kind of fashion. But I say in this show, Strength to Be Human, it's not some moniker. It's just really the metaphor about making sure, and in my original thesis, it's about putting aside religion and science and just trying to be the best that you can and not let those things hold you back, but let them help inform you. Well, I think it goes to a teacher, too, that sometimes you got to be stronger than a teacher in order to be able to teach.
Well, I mean, for me, as a teacher, I was compassionate, and I would like to think that students could come to me and felt comfortable in coming to me. But, you know, teaching... if you're teaching theater or even English, which are the subjects I taught, you know, students would write in their journal entries to me. So there was always a lot of back and forth. Like, I know that they knew if they didn't feel comfortable in saying it to me verbally, they could write it to me. And of course, if you're teaching theater, then you're always hearing students and their expressions. So teaching in those fields, sometimes I think, because I would have students for 4 years, so from freshman through the time they graduated, you really get to know students that way. And so I think, you know, you start putting 40, 50 kids in a classroom, the teacher barely knows their name. You know, you lose some of that connection with them, and I think that's when they start to pull away and think no one cares. So, I didn't have that experience, or at least I don't think that I did. Students felt comfortable with me, and I felt comfortable with them. But I can see how it happens. It's a broken system at times. And, you know, just asking Matt that question only just further proved to me that there are those students that feel that way. And he's just a success story. And I was so happy to see the outcome of his story be different than, you know, many others that may not have turned out so well.
Wow. I love teachers, by the way. It's not a coincidence that the first three people I interviewed all happened to be teachers as well as artists and writers. So, but
I hope our governor of the state of Kentucky, I hope he's listening to this. Love teachers. Go, Matt Bevin.
Fund,
I hope you don't mind me saying
not
that.
Not at all. Fund the arts right now, please, okay?
That's right.
More arts and crafts in there as well. So I'm definitely excited to hear about that. And to talk a little bit more about teachers, now that I'm a father and I have two small children in elementary school, the experience for me is completely different, because I feel, as much as I love teachers and have a better understanding about how they operate, I sometimes find that, you know, I don't always have a teacher in front of my my child, but sometimes I just have somebody that's just doing their job, even if it's doing it well. I don't really feel the same connection that I used to when I was younger. Maybe just because, you know, I've seen a lot more, or maybe just because those times were different than they are now. But I would think that teaching would be the same, and in many instances, it doesn't seem to be. And when I do find that one special teacher, I feel that same excitement again. So, you know, there is a difference in sometimes even in teachers on those that can make people be engaged to their subject, and others that are simply going through the numbers until they go home.
Very true. And I know for me personally, I couldn't stand to be a boring teacher because it would bore me to death. So I knew if I was going to be in this career, I was going to have to be engaging because, you know, I have a short attention span, I guess. I like to be engaged, and I wanted to teach in a way that would engage students, because otherwise, you know, why waste 27 years of your life being bored?
It just wasn't
for me.
I know exactly what you're saying, because that's what I was talking to my wife about when I was doing this show here, and because she's been wanting me to do it for a while. And I said, I have to do it my way on things that I find interesting and in a format that, you know, I can really be engaged in, because it can't be some boring formula, and it can't be some stuff that somebody else did, even if they did it well and was successful. If it can't be my own stamp on it, and I don't mean that in some kind of egotistical way. I just mean that in a sense of I know Mark Anthony Rossi more than anybody else does, and I can't go about doing this and learning all this stuff and being out there if I am behind the scenes of like, oh, God, I can't wait for this to end. No, I can't. If I'm going to have
but
that
you're
feeling,
not thinking that today, right?
No, I never think that. And the reason why I never think that is...
You don't
is,
want this one to end.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't want any of them to end, even though my standalone shows, because if you're not truly interested in it, it's not going to be good. People are not going to respond to it. And I'm not going to feel that I want to go do it again. So as long as I can keep myself interested, well, I'm going to also be an active partner in it too. Even though the nature of this particular segment is really about, you know, having the artist, or in this case, you know, artists, be more of the subject. But in the end, yeah, you have to be engaged, and you have to be committed, and you have to be interested in it. So I hope that people hear that more and more on the shows. A lot of times I get comments about that very thing, which is great to hear. I'm always excited to hear that. They don't have to always be public. They can be private. But whatever we're doing, if it's boring, then you need to stop it and do something else. That's just that simple. I don't care if it's a job, or if it's a creation, or if it's a project you're doing. And I don't want to sound controversial, but I'm telling you, even if it's a relationship, if it's getting boring, either you need to figure out ways to fix it to be unboring, or maybe just move on to yourself or to someone else. Because this is what roots, I think this is where the roots are of where discontent comes from. And then ultimately you get lazy and you get sloppy. And sometimes people even get in a ways where they harm themselves through health or just through, you know, the psychological mechanisms going through life, because they're doing things that ultimately they don't want to do.
And, you know, I think, like, the play sort of addresses that a little, because I think people feel stuck and they feel like they don't have options. Maybe they are bored, but they don't know, like, okay, you know, I need my paycheck, so I'm going to stay stuck in this job. And then, you know, after you've been there a little while, it seems like, you know, well, I've been here this many years, I've only got this many to go, so why make it, you know, there's always going to be a reason to stay stuck if you choose that. So the play really addresses the fact that Matt, he could have stayed stuck. He could have stayed stuck in the first marriage. He could have stayed stuck, you know, numerous times. But the difference with him was, you know, even though he didn't just like, okay, I'm leaving this marriage right this second. I mean, he was stuck to a degree, you know, for some time, but there was a plan, and there was a conscious decision. I'm not going to remain stuck. So I think that's what people have to start thinking about if they are bored or whatever their situation is, that, you know, you can always find more reasons to stay stuck than you can, because it's hard. It's hard to make changes. But if you don't make them and you just keep looking for, I'll do it, you know, in 5 years or 10 years, or then that time is gone and you're still stuck. And so I think that's really good what you said about encouraging people not to, to stay in relationships or in anything. That's just wasting your life, basically.
It is. And I don't want to try to sound like some kind of Dr. Phil, you know, knockoff over here. But the truth of the matter is that not only is time short, in many instances, time can be long. Imagine being in something long that you just totally hate. I talk to people all the time behind the scenes, and they tell me how much they love creating and writing and how much they absolutely hate their job. One guy tells me that he literally physically has problems doing his job, not because it requires like muscles, just because it requires him to stop vomiting in his head, because that's how much he hates it. That's pretty much the term he used too, vomiting in my head, which is like, wow, that's some hatred right there. And I'm like, really? Maybe you need to figure out ways to get around that or go to something else. And because I find the happier people are the ones that have taken the most risks. And without trying to sound too philosophical on the show, I find that's the case. I had a woman.
Well, I will say with a play that I never felt stuck or bored in this whole process with Matt. He is a highly entertaining person. And so, I don't think we'll ever stop working with each other based on the fact that we would be bored, because, that hasn't been the case from my perspective.
Well, I can't say that I'm terribly surprised about his situation, because we've seen a number of historical examples. And I don't mean to compare you to Einstein, but it makes a perfect part of the show and the understanding that there are simply some people that they need enough freedom in order for them to pursue what they already naturally gifted at. And sometimes an educational or even an occupational structure sort of stifles that. I mean, I might be venturing here, but I got the feeling that if he was more in that academic setting, he might not be able to blossom to where he became.
I think it would have been a little bit easier in some ways if I had stayed in school. I wouldn't have had to learn everything on my own. Like, I can do engineering type work. I don't have the training for it, but, I can put together things that need to be put together, and I'm paid to do that. So, it just would have been a little easier if I'd stayed in school, because I would have known what I needed to know and not had to learn it all by myself. So there would have been that structure, I think. It would have been hard, though, because I'm not one for the structure of education and, right, having to turn in papers and things like that. So I would have suffered there, I think.
Exactly. And there's a lot of examples of that. And like I said, Einstein is definitely one of them. A lot of people are not aware of that he couldn't even do his own tax return. Why couldn't he do that? Because simple addition was so boring to him. He was so out there trying to realize the realities of the cosmos that, the IRS is like, I'm going to yawn and hire somebody to do this because I'm supposed to be this incredible genius. I can't even do it.
Well, I'm certainly no Einstein.
Oh, I don't know, Mark. I can see his head growing now. He's got a play in Einstein, and I can see what's happening.
There's similarities to people that feel that, for one way or the other, have to be self-taught to really kind of get what they need to get done, because an academic or a more formal setting is simply not going to do that. So it might not be a coincidence in many ways, the path that either you took or took for you, because we've seen plenty of examples of that even in the arts, where folks that have done something that they're not supposed to be able to do and didn't have any formal training and taught themselves. We got painters that have done this. We got writers that have done this. Gandhi used to mention all the time that he's supposed to have been doing what he was doing, but he was too busy being a bad lawyer. A lot of people don't realize that. He was a horrible lawyer in South Africa, didn't get anything done until he realized, holy moly, I don't know what I'm doing. My arguments stink. How about I go back to what my heart's telling me to do because I think this will work? And then what did he do? He literally changed the world just by stopping being a bad lawyer.
Right. I think I reached a point where I had decided that I wanted to do things that I wanted to do rather than what I had to do or was expected of me to do or whatever. So that helped me focus a little bit more and kind of branch off on my own path rather than worrying about what other people thought. And, you know, because I really don't. I do, you know, not that I don't mean to sound selfish in a way, but I kind of do the things that interest me. And, you know, I choose projects to work on based on how interesting they are and how much they benefit others and things like that. So, I mean, I can see what you're saying. You know, maybe people need to make that break and not worry so much about what others think and, you know, are they doing the right thing in others' eyes, I guess.
Yeah, and it's real important because, and how it relates to the arts on the show and your example and what Kat has done is to remind people, and sometimes they continue to be reminded, and I'll continue to remind them on this show, that academic is important. And sure, education is important. And even certain trainings about certain elements of being creative is important. But it is not the be-all. I cannot tell you how many people have told me regrettably that they got that master's in fine arts and then realized they didn't need it to be creative, and they were creative all through that. But because they doubted themselves, or they believed that someone said they had to have this, they felt they wasted time, they wasted money. One lady said, I could have had my novel out 3 years ago if I just stopped for a moment. So to hear that, it's sad, but it's also to try to remind people, too, that you can still do things on your own. And to work on things on your own is not selfish. To me, it's an element of self-respect.
Yeah, there are other paths than education. I mean, there are people who will say that you must get a degree and you'll never go anywhere without one. But, I mean, I'm living proof that, you know, it isn't necessary. So,
right.
In some ways, I guess.
And I got you on that. And I think people will hear that on the show as well, that we're certainly not mocking educators or education. We're just saying that you often need to evaluate yourself and keep those things in the proper perspective. You know, if you're writing a novel and it's going great, why do you need to stop in the middle of it to go get an MFA and then find out that you lost all these opportunities on finishing it and getting it out there? You got friends who already have their novels out and you're still in the middle of it because you got an MFA. And only again, you got a piece of paper in the end and you didn't get your project done. So again, those are choices, of course, that you're making. But sometimes those choices, that they're influenced. But I feel like a reverse fear. You know, if I don't get this extra thing, I won't be this, I won't be that. Listen, you can always get that other thing later, but you might not be able to finish that novel. You might not be interested anymore. You might have lost some of the oomph to get it going. Or God forbid, in some cases, your health could decline in the middle of all this. So some of these choices that people make, they're not always the best just because society says so.
Right. I agree 100%.
Well, of course, I agree. So, I think one of the questions people ask is how we're the same and how we're different. And, you know, perhaps that's one way, because I did go the traditional path. I didn't want to be an English major. I started as a music major. And then I thought, there's not going to be any jobs in music. So, I just flipped and made music a minor and English a major. I hated to read. Like, my whole life I thought, you know, English would be the last thing in the world that I would do, because I've never been one, like my friends, always carrying books around reading. That was just never me. But one thing I did discover in college is that I liked reading, but I liked reading dialogue. So once I was turned on to reading plays, you know, I knew that that was me. So it's not that I don't like to read. I just like to read plays. You know, I don't care how a tree looks, and I don't want to read like five paragraphs describing the color of the sky and all that. I mean, because to me, it just doesn't matter. You can say the sky's there and I know what it looks like. But dialogue is different to me. What people say, how they say it, how they interact, that's very interesting. So, you know, there have been a million music jobs since I made that decision to be an English major. So you just never know how it's going to turn out. But, you know, I could have written my plays without ever going to college. You know, I could have done that. But I could not have taught, and that's been equally important in my life, I think, touching students in a motivational way through education. That's been very important to me as well, and I think playwriting is just one way that I've tried to continue, you know, making a difference, and I try to choose topics in my plays that I think someone will benefit from. And I'll just say this, you know, May I Have Your Attention, Please? You mentioned, like, that's been performed all over the U.S. and Canada and some other countries as well. But sometimes I get to hear, especially now with social media being so accessible, I get to hear from the schools or the students. And so one school in Nebraska, they performed May I Have Your Attention, Please? At a competition. And there was a girl from an opposing school that had been considering suicide. And after she saw their performance, she came to them and told them that, you know, she had planned to commit suicide, and that seeing their performance of the play had saved her life. And they didn't win the competition, but they had put in their yearbook, so where the seniors said, you know, what they remembered of their year. And that was what they remembered, was saving the girl's life. They didn't care if they didn't win the competition. They cared that their message, something they had done through the arts, you know, had impacted someone else to such a degree. And so it's stories like that that's what I want to hear from Matt's story as well. Because then I feel like I've made a difference. So you get to make a difference as the playwright, the actors get to, you know, it just keeps going. And then you don't know what the girl that was going to commit suicide, you know, does she go out and then, you know, maybe she starts doing something to help other people. So it's a domino effect. And to me, that's my mission, and that's what I hope to accomplish with the arts. That's what I hope I'll be remembered for in my writing.
It's a beautiful statement, and thank you, Kat, for all the work you did. Matt, thank you for being who you are. It's not only an inspiration, and I don't mean that in a reality talk show kind of sense. I mean an inspiration of reminding us about how there's still so much potential out there in people, but it lies untapped when they don't make the proper choices, or if they don't figure out ways to overcome their fear. My closing thought about the show is simply this, folks, and how you can sort of make a connection on what a lot of these brave people have done and what they're going to probably continue to do in the future. There's a voice inside of us. It's a small voice. Sometimes we don't always pay attention to it, but it's always there. And if we want to be having the strength to be human, you have to ignore the science and the religion and the prejudice out there in society, or even our own families, because they're telling us something that doesn't really jive with that voice. It doesn't necessarily mean that they are wrong, or that they're wrong-headed, or that they're evil. It just means that the direction they're saying doesn't fit to who our voice is saying we need to go. And if we don't listen to that, we have problems. You find people later on in lives are like, I should have this, I should have did that. What do you think they're saying that for? Because they knew that that voice was there. They decided to not to go with that for whatever reason. The ones that do, the ones that pick up on it, even if it takes a little while, those are the people, they become more successful. They become more happy. They become more content. They feel that whatever years they have left in their life, you know, they've lived them rather than just simply being on the sidelines. So, folks, let's not be on the sidelines from things. Let's go out there and do what's necessary. And if we have to make a change, yes, change is scary. I got that. I'm doing something right now that last year I would have said, oh, no. So it can be scary, but it also can be rewarding, and it could be what we're supposed to have been doing all along. God bless you, folks. Thank you very much, Kat and Matt, for being on the show and making it so special, so entertaining, so informative, and so educational, and definitely something that I think creative people can take from and use in their lives.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
God bless, folks.
Thank you for listening. Please follow the show and visit our blog at strengthtobehuman.blogspot.com.